You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. The high rate of C-sections is a heated topic lately. In Florida last month, one woman unsuccessfully took her hospital to federal court to avoid having one. It's life-saving surgery and complicated births, but today nearly a third of pregnancies end up as a C-section. Public health officials across the U.S. are saying the number of C-sections being performed has gotten way out of hand. And as Jessica Robinson reports, doctors are wondering if their definition of what a normal labor is might be one of the problems.
Now, you might be thinking, this is about elective C-sections. There's been a flurry of stories in recent years about that phenomenon.
Concerns over the rising number of C-sections being performed purely for scheduling convenience.
We thought that that might have been a big contributor.
Dr. Aaron Coy is the chair of obstetrics and gynecology at Oregon Health and Science University.
But it doesn't appear that elective C-section is the huge driver. I would say no bigger than a 1% to 2% problem.
Coy sits on a national panel that explored potential causes of the high rate. And it would be nice if it were one simple thing. But it's more complicated than that. Older women getting pregnant, an increase in fertility treatments, legal liability, all these things and more contribute to the problem. But Coy says one thing is certain.
We've seen the cesarean delivery rate rise over the last 15 to 20 years for no good medical reason.
And Dr. Coy says there is one particular factor that makes a huge difference. It's how you define a normal labor.
Everybody gets a little impatient for the baby toward the end of pregnancy.
Educational film reels like this one from 1950 describe the typical experience for a mother-to-be. And it turns out our modern standard for labor goes back just as far. In the 50s, a physician named Emanuel Friedman tracked the labors of hundreds of women and came up with what's known as the Friedman curve. And Dr. Coy says it's stuck.
The Friedman curve is still the curve that is going to be in essentially every textbook on the planet today.
And he will be a fine, healthy baby, announcing his arrival with a good, loud cry.
Here's the problem. Friedman's studies were not rigorous by today's standards. For one thing, he excluded some data that seemed outside the norm. As a result, the Friedman curve shows labor starting earlier and progressing faster. Dr. Coy says when you restrict the definition of normal, you get to abnormal much quicker, and that's contributed to doctors jumping in sooner.
And all data since then points to a longer length of time and a much wider range of normal. In other words, there are women that take a lot longer in labor, and that's okay.
Dr. Coy helped write a new set of C-section guidelines released earlier this year by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. The basic message is, be patient, which might be easier said than done.
Are you checking her?
No, I'm just going to say hi real quick.
Okay.
It's almost 7 o'clock on a Thursday night at Valley Hospital in Spokane, and Dr. Nathan Meltzer is still at work. He has one mother in labor. She's been here for more than 12 hours.
It would be very easy to, you know, encourage her to say, you know, we gave it a good try, but it's 7 o'clock and I could do a C-section right now and be home with my family in time for dinner. It's tempting, but it's not the right thing. The right thing is to wait and see how this plays out. Whether it ends up being a C-section at midnight or a C-section tomorrow or a vaginal birth, any time between now and when it happens, you know, it's willing to wait and give it some time.
The fetal heart rate monitor is a comforting sound to Kelly, the mother-to-be. She looks surprisingly relaxed, propped up on some pillows in her hospital room. She has had an epidural. This is her second pregnancy. The first time, Kelly had to have a C-section. Some doctors wouldn't even try a vaginal birth after a previous cesarean, but Kelly was determined not to have another section.
It was scary. I feel like you can't breathe. When they pulled my daughter out, all I could do is reach for her hand, and then I puked and went to recovery, so I didn't get to spend time with her or anything.
And mother-infant bonding isn't the only issue. A C-section is major surgery. It includes all the possible surgery risks, like infection and blood clots, and it has a much longer recovery period for the new mother.
I just kept waking up, can I see my daughter? No, not yet.
All good reasons for hospitals around the country to reduce the C-section rate. At 13%, Valley Hospital has one of the lowest section rates for low-risk pregnancies in Washington. But it's a small hospital. Rates have reached 30% at larger hospitals, though some are now reversing that trend.
We've found that our C-section rates actually have
dropped fairly significantly.
Dr. Tanya Sorensen specializes in maternal-fetal medicine at Swedish Hospital in Seattle. The rate for C-sections on low-risk pregnancies here has gone from 31 to 26% in just 6 months. Swedish is one of 17 hospitals involved in a pilot program aimed at reducing unnecessary C-sections. One big push is to track data and get doctors to rethink that Friedman labor curve they learned about in school, and also to re-educate mothers and their partners that with labor, it's okay to be patient. Dr. Sorensen cautions, though, the end goal of reducing C-sections shouldn't be a number. It should be patient health.
One thing we are absolutely not wanting to do is decrease the C-section rate at the risk of mother or baby safety.
And speaking of mothers and babies, Kelly, our patient from earlier in the story, found the waiting paid off for her. About 20 minutes before midnight, after pushing for a little over an hour, Colton was born. No C-section required. In Spokane, I'm Jessica Robinson.
There was a time when midwives delivered most babies, but in recent decades in the U.S., that practice has become the domain of obstetricians. We're coming full circle. These days, more women are choosing midwives for maternal care. From Seattle, Ruby DeLuna reports some hospitals are even adding midwifery as one way to expand their service and to help reduce unnecessary C-sections.
All right, let's see if we can hear baby here.
At Island Women's Healthcare in Coopville, Washington, Sarah Meyer is pressing a fetal Doppler on Christine Meyer's belly to check the baby's heart rate.
Great, that's good. So about 140. Perfect. Did you hear
Meyer, no relation to Christine, then checks her ankles for swelling. Christine is 25 years old, and this is her first baby. She says she chose Whidbey General because the hospital offers what she's looking for. A midwife.
I love it. I love Sarah. She's such a cool, you know, laid back. I've heard great things about her from the nurses at the hospital. They think she's just fantastic. So I'm excited to have her there while I'm, you know, giving birth.
Whidbey General is the latest to join other Washington hospitals like Swedish, Northwest, and Overlake that have added midwives to their rosters. The state is trying to reduce the number of C-sections that are not medically necessary. Whidbey General has one of the highest rates in the state, but that number is going down. In 2012, nearly half of first-time low-risk moms had C-sections. So far this year, it's one-third. The hospital made some changes, and that included hiring a midwife. Sarah Meyer is a certified nurse midwife. She joined the hospital in February last year. She delivers babies and can order epidurals or pain meds like obstetricians, but her approach is more focused on using natural remedies, fewer drugs.
All the intervention that we have is important, and there's certainly times when we need to use it and use all of it, but not in every birth. Women have kind of lost the kind of rite of passage that birth can be, and we need to remember that this is absolutely a life-changing event that can be really powerful for women.
Meyer started practicing in her native New Zealand, where it's common for midwives to work alongside obstetricians. But there are clear boundaries. Midwives care for women like Christine. Normal pregnancy, no complications.
Obstetricians are the specialists who would look after women that were considered high risk, so they would have medical conditions that would affect them in pregnancy, or if they had problems in labour, then the midwives would consult the obstetricians and they would be called.
In the U.S., midwives and obstetricians don't often practice together, but the walls are slowly coming down. At Whidbey General, Meyer works with two obstetricians. Patients can choose Meyer to deliver, but if complications come up during pregnancy or a delivery requires specialized care, one of the obstetricians steps in. Dr. Robert Burnett has worked with midwives throughout his 35-year career, so it wasn't a big adjustment. He says having a midwife provides a different option for those who want it.
They do a lot more hand-holding, you know, they're the whole time during labor type thing, where we tend to have our labor and delivery nurses manage a lot of those sort of things, and we're kind of the overseer to make sure things are going well and there's no complications happening.
Burnett doesn't think having a midwife alone has made an impact on lowering the hospital's C-section rates. He says the state has new guidelines like allowing women more time for their labor to progress. Many of those steps are consistent with midwifery practices, and the combination has made a difference. And it has helped providers like him when they counsel women who are anxious to speed up their delivery.
They're tired, they're uncomfortable, they're swollen, they don't feel good, and they want to be done. And then, you know, well, my due date was yesterday, why can't we do something about it? And it's really hard to put them off. Now, actually, it's easier because we say, we have these policies. And, you know, everything, I know you're uncomfortable, but everything's normal with your pregnancy. It's safer for us to give you more time to go into labor.
Burnett expects to see more of this type of integration as healthcare costs continue to rise. The big drawback, he says, is that a midwife can't take calls for him. It has to be another obstetrician.
So let's see, Miss Christine, what else do we need to think about today?
Back in the exam room, Sarah Meyer orders another blood pressure check before Christine leaves. She also reminds her the prenatal checkups will become more frequent as her due date approaches.
We need to see you every 2 weeks.
Oh, my gosh.
From now.
I can't believe I only have 9 weeks.
And so, you know, next week, next time when we meet, we might talk a little bit about, you know, kind of labor preparation. And
Meyer reassures Christine she'll be in the room with her when she's in active labor. When Meyer arrived at Whidbey General, there were some initial adjustments in the office and in the delivery room. Now they're at a point where their practice more resembles her experience in New Zealand.
What I love about this practice is that the obstetricians and I really work collaboratively, and so we support each other, and I actually think that that's the best way that midwives and obstetricians work, as if we are together as one team.
The hospital staff may be on board, but some patients are still learning about midwifery. Meyer says it's going to take a little time and word of mouth before expecting mothers know the service is available in their community. I'm Ruby DeLuna reporting.
In the event of a medical or any other emergency, the last thing you want to hear is, "I can't understand you." The reality is, emergency dispatchers in the Northwest generally speak one language, English. But in our increasingly polyglot society, some people in distress inevitably cannot communicate in English. Correspondent Tom Bonzi takes us inside a 911 call center to find out what happens then.
The emergency call you're about to hear came into the Willamette Valley 911 Center in Salem, Oregon, but it could have been almost anywhere in the West. A call in a foreign language is a daily or almost daily occurrence in this region's urban counties.
911.
Bueno, es para mí.
So, do you have an emergency? Do you have an emergency?
Sí.
Wait just a moment.
At this point, the dispatcher clicks a speed dial button to conference in an interpreter. Every 911 center in the Northwest has a contract with an emergency translation service like this.
Thank you for calling. What language?
Spanish.
Thanks for your operator number. One moment, please.
Thank you. Your call may be monitored or recorded.
On this call, it takes 55 precious seconds for the translator to come on the line.
We will be with you shortly.
Veteran call taker and training manager Andrea Tobin says the wait can be excruciating, though you can't hear it in the dispatcher's voice.
We get pretty tense, especially if we know it's a medical call or this person that is in obvious distress.
Okay.
We listen back to the call at Tobin's desk.
This is where I was a little startled. You know, it sounds like I'm calling a catalog company a little bit. I know it's
correct.
Not,
when it's Spanish, it's pretty quick and easy for us to understand. When it's a different dialect, it becomes more complicated for us because we don't recognize them all. And then they put us on hold
while they get an interpreter that is the language that we need. And that can sometimes be very quick. Sometimes it's 30 seconds or a minute.
Hi, my name is Luz. My ID is...
Translation companies such as Telelanguage and LanguageLine boast they have interpreters for 200 languages available. Willamette Valley 911 Director Mark Buckles says they bill the government by the minute.
We pay for those services as we use them, so we only use 2 calls a day. We pay for that service rather than, if I were to have an entire staff with every language available, the expense would be, just beyond our ability to fund.
Buckholz says 3 of the 55 people on his staff who answer calls are certified bilingual, 2 in Spanish, 1 in Russian. In our region, Spanish is by far the most common requested language for emergency translation, typically followed by Russian, Vietnamese, and Chinese in varying order. Lately, call center supervisors in Boise and Seattle say they're seeing African and Middle Eastern languages crop up, a consequence of refugee inflows, perhaps. Buckholz says centers like his actively recruit for bilingual call takers, but they're hard to find.
So it's really tough to require a second language as a requirement to work for us. While it's important, we do pay a bonus. The volume isn't significant enough for us to have that an exclusive requirement for hiring.
At the Salem 911 Center, it's 3 minutes into the call from the running man. He says 2 men in a car are chasing him, possibly from the hospital. The call taker and interpreter go several rounds with the guy trying to figure out where this is happening.
No, aquí estoy parado.
En la esquina de Lee Street y One Way.
Uh-huh.
I'm standing right on the corner of One Way and Lee Street.
We don't have One Way.
It took the trio another minute to figure out the intersection was actually Lee and 12th. Interpreters who join calls like this may be located halfway across the country. The companies they work for advertise this as a rewarding job that can be done from home. The same companies also translate for business call centers, banks, schools, and courts. In the case of our Salem emergency, a squad car rolls up to the scene before the call taker and interpreter get through the standard questions.
Do you see the officers?
¿Usted ya ve a los oficiales? Yeah. Yes.
Can you stop and talk to them?
This didn't end so well for the caller. Guadalupe Salazar was subsequently arrested for misuse of 911. The police report indicates he showed signs of paranoia and intoxication. No one was seen chasing him. Salazar was referred to a mental evaluation. After reviewing the case, the district attorney chose not to press charges. I'm Tom Bonsi in Salem, Oregon.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Still ahead, crowdfunding is an increasingly popular way for small businesses to raise the cash they need for startup costs or expansion. Last year, the Columbian Theater in Astoria successfully used a Kickstarter campaign to raise the funds needed to upgrade to a digital movie projection system. Agricultural businesses are now coming on board. We'll hear about a small dairy near Eugene seeking to expand its herd of goats in order to expand its base of customers.
We haven't had a herd big enough. For example, the raw milk, haven't been able to begin to fill our orders.
Rachel McDonald reports just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Patchy fog before 11 this morning, otherwise sunny. Highs in the high 70s. Light northeast winds becoming north 5 to 10 miles per hour this morning. Then for tonight, clear overnight lows in the low to mid 50s. A goat dairy near Eugene is suffering from its own success. What has been a labor of love for many years is becoming impossible to sustain without an infusion of cash. Rachel McDonald reports Fern Edge Dairy is turning to crowdfunding to stay alive.
Sherry Reyna has been tending her Mount Zion dairy goat herd on this land southeast of Eugene since the 1970s. She and her partner Fred Warner own Fern's Edge Dairy, which produces popular Chèvre and other cheeses.
And you can come in.
Raina takes me on a tour of the dairy.
This is where we age our cheese.
Inside the cooler, she points to the aging goat goudas on shelves.
We're going to have caraway gouda very soon and cumin gouda. It's not quite ready. It has to wait.
This is a farmstead dairy. The goats are milked every morning and evening, and the milk is pumped directly into the dairy to be made into cheese. Fern's Edge is the only goat dairy in Oregon licensed to sell raw milk.
We strive to be super local, super sustainable, you know, and have these great relationships with other small farmers that is beneficial to all of us.
For example, the mushrooms for Fern's Edge Chanterelle Chèvre come from the vendor next door to her at the farmer's market. The goats eat spent grain from local agrarian ales. Goats relax in the shady barn near the dairy. Raina says there's not enough room here for her to increase milk production. That's the problem. Fern's Edge is successful and popular, but it can't meet demand.
We haven't had a herd big enough to, for example, the raw milk. We haven't been able to begin to fill our orders. And there's a waiting list of places that want to buy it, but we don't have enough.
Meanwhile, the cost of organic feed keeps rising. Alfalfa has to be trucked from eastern Oregon, and it's expensive. Raina herself delivers cheese and milk to Portland, Corvallis, and Salem in an old van with 300,000 miles on it. She says she's never gotten any money out of the dairy.
Why do we do it? We produce a really excellent product. Our customers love us, and we love our customers. We employ people that depend on us, but we have put money in every month, and we've just frankly run out of money. We live on Social Security.
So Raina is hoping a Kickstarter campaign will help them expand the barn and pay for feed so they can increase the herd and the supply of milk. At the Lane County Farmers Market, it's clear the cheese is a big hit. Raina and her assistant stand at a table with trays of samples of the many different flavors of soft goat cheese.
Have you had our cheese before?
People gather round tasting.
So good. This is like our favorite.
Phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Sherry Raina says if the Kickstarter campaign is successful, the funds will help the farm increase capacity and pay for feed. Otherwise, she doesn't think the business will make it. She says four other goat dairies in Oregon have gone out of business in recent months.
Having a labor of love is really great if you can afford it. But we've come to rock bottom. We have no more money to put into it.
Raina is hoping to raise $60,000 by September 3rd. I'm Rachel McDonald reporting.
Finally, five Pacific Northwest colleges have banded together to offer their first joint class this summer. Administrators hope the course will set the stage for even more cross-campus offerings. Students from three of the colleges are traveling across Washington and Oregon, studying how food moves from field to table and beyond. Reporter Kyle Stokes caught up with the class on a recent stop.
University of Puget Sound professor Emily Piney has brought her students to the very end of the food system, Tacoma's wastewater treatment plant.
It's got a nice musky smell, you know?
Yeah, it's very earthy.
Yeah. It's poop.
It's poop. That's what it is.
What I really wanted to show you here, if you look off in the distance...
A city employee leads students between murky treatment pools the size of baseball diamonds. The class is here to study the city's method for turning wastewater into soils for lawns and gardens. You've never seen 10 college students more excited about a waste treatment plant.
From what part of the process does the liquid come from again?
So it's after digestion.
Tim Daly is the inquisitive one. He's a senior at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon. Oregon. During this 3-week summer course, he's watched combines comb eastern Washington's wheat fields, and this week will tend to a small farm in the forests of the Willamette Valley. Daly's kicking around a career in organic farming, and he says the travel has helped challenge his perceptions of our food system.
You get to see just, yeah, the entire spectrum of the agricultural system in the Northwest, and so, yeah, it's been really incredible. It's the first time I'd ever seen a conventional farm, really.
Daly's taking the food systems class with 5 students from Tacoma's University of Puget Sound and 4 others from Whitman College in Walla Walla. Along with Lewis and Clark and Reed Colleges in Portland, these schools formed the Northwest 5 Consortium in 2011. This course is one of the consortium's first stabs at creating a program any one of these colleges might struggle to pull off alone. Professor Piney says she's had help from other faculty at Puget Sound, Whitman, and Willamette, and Northwest 5 Consortium leaders say they're trying to replicate Piney's course and find other ways their small colleges can work together. I'm Kyle Stokes in Seattle.
And that is all for today's edition of The Bridge. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the home page. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgain saying thank you for listening today. Listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.